Hey guys, when you search for Bible-related stuff, virtually all the results are from Christian pastors and apologists.
Yeah, to find real biblical criticism, you need to dig down. Most people never even learn about all the scholarship out there, which debunks a lot of the evangelical claims.
Yeah, there's an entire well-funded industry of biased Christian content out there.
Our show tries to offer a counter-argument to them, but we rely on our listeners to keep the show going week after week. If you'd like to support the show, please check out our Patreon at www.patreon.com/skepticsbibleproject.
Thank you to all those supporting us. We hope you enjoy the show. I'm John.
And I'm Ben.
And this is the Skeptics Bible Project. We read the Bible
so you don't have to.
I don't care too much for preachers. I don't like to go to church. But I'd hate to meet St. Peter when my body leaves this earth.
Hello and welcome to the show. Happy to be back with you again. This is the Skeptics Bible Project. How are you, Ben?
I'm good. How are you, John?
I'm doing well. So we're continuing on with our series on pseudepigrapha, or forgeries, in the New Testament. And tonight we're going to talk about the pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, letters purported to be from the Apostle Paul, and we'll talk about whether or not they're genuine. But I thought, Ben, we'd start out just by talking a little bit about how everybody is stealing our ideas. You, I think, sent me a couple videos on other podcasters on YouTube, taking some of our best material.
I'm a big fan of the Data Over Dogma podcast with Dan McClellan and Dan Beecher. And it was funny, I was watching one of their more recent episodes, and they were doing a segment called Bible versus Bible.
Oh, sounds familiar.
Obviously, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. So
I'd like to think that we are getting so influential that they're taking our ideas, or if it's just such an obvious idea that other people were going to come up with that as well.
Either way, we're really on the vanguard of what's happening in biblical scholarship. So especially when it comes to public-facing scholarship, I'm a big fan of everything Dan does to bring biblical scholarship to the masses.
I'm preparing a cease and desist letter for Dan. So Dan, if you're listening, you should be expecting that soon. Also, Ben, Bart Ehrman, I believe, had something similar to our Bible Says What concept. I don't remember the exact words. Something along those lines. And it made me think, is Bart Ehrman listening to us? I really hope that he is, although somehow I just don't think so.
As much as these ideas are ingenious and trademarked, clearly there's a lot of crazy stuff in the Bible that makes you say, what?
All of this is in good fun, and they are welcome to use anything they want.
At least until the lawyers get involved.
Why don't we jump right in? The pastoral epistles, let's start with this, Ben. Why are they called the pastoral epistles?
It has to do with who they're addressed to, specifically Timothy, but also to the leaders of the churches in Ephesus, and instructions pertaining to qualifications for leadership and church practices.
The whole subject of this episode, or I should say these episodes, because I have a feeling this might stretch into two, did Paul, in fact, write these letters? But I also thought we should spend some time talking a little bit about some of the content within the letters. They're very controversial. You know, we might go off subject a little bit outside of just the question of, are these forgeries? Spoiler alert, they're very much forgeries. This is something that is well known in academia for many, many years. If anything in the Pauline corpus is a forgery that's canonical, the pastoral epistles definitely are the top of the list. And there's a lot of reasons, and we're going to talk about why scholars believe that the Apostle Paul did not write these letters, written after the actual life of the real Paul. But there's also a lot in these letters that are controversial. So you'll often hear people say things like defending pseudepigraph in the Bible, and they'll say, okay, well, let's say you throw out this or throw out that. Would it really affect anything in the teaching of Christianity? And I think this is example number one. Yeah, if the Apostle Paul did not write these, if these are not genuine letters, and if the church should not be using these letters, what would it change in the church? Well, it would change quite a bit, because these letters, the pastoral epistles, have been very instrumental in a lot of church doctrine, which has affected a lot of people through the centuries.
There are very significant differences between the pastoral epistles perspective and the seven undisputed letters of Paul. And this is something that's been known for critical scholars since the 1800s, the pastoral epistles, basically almost universally rejected as forgeries by critical scholars. They were some of the first letters that were noticed, and people were questioning to say, wait, this doesn't seem like something Paul wrote. So one issue is, did Paul write this letter? And then the second issue is, why does it matter? It would make a huge difference the way churches are organized, authority structures, who can be in ministry, qualifications for ministry, attitudes on marriage and family, attitude towards women. All of these things are affected by the pastoral epistles, seemingly in contrast to what is revealed in Paul's genuine letter. You end up with a totally different picture of Paul than if you have these separated. This is a significant question that should matter to Christians. It really does make a huge difference.
Before we even get into the linguistic and stylistic reasons that scholars dispute the authentic authorship by Paul, there's also a problem because of citations from the early church fathers. Compared to the undisputed letters of Paul, the pastoral epistles, they're notably absent from the writings of the early church fathers. The letters that are universally accepted, such as Romans and Corinthians, they're extensively cited by early Christian authors like Clement of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, Polycarp. But the pastoral epistles receive far less attention. They don't quote them. The church fathers often quote things from Paul's letters to support their theological arguments and teachings. However, the pastoral epistles are rarely quoted in the writings of the early church fathers. And that kind of indicates that they really weren't widely known or accepted as authoritative text in the early Christian community. The other thing is that they were kind of omitted from canonical lists. Early lists of canonical writings, such as the Muratorian fragment in 2nd century, and even the Canon of Marcion, Ben, which we've talked about, they omit the pastoral epistles. This suggests that these letters may not have been universally recognized or accepted as Pauline writings in the early church.
Marcion is actually pretty significant. At least in his mind, he's following Paul's teaching. It's hard to make an argument from silence, but we don't have a lot of early attestation to these books at all.
Yeah, it really wasn't until the late 2nd and early 3rd century that we begin to see explicit references to the pastoral epistles. Irenaeus and Tertullian did start referencing these books. That delayed acknowledgement suggests that the pastoral epistles may have taken time to gain recognition and acceptance.
The internal arguments are always a little bit more convincing than the external argument. The internal content is going to align with that external idea as well, that these are just later. And they address issues that were not issues in Paul's day.
So let me take a step back and talk about why this is so important. The pastoral epistles are fundamental in modern Protestant Christianity in structuring how the church should be laid out. Because they are, quote unquote, the pastoral epistles. They are talking about church structure and the order of things and how things should be done. It is the basis for the modern church. And this is so important. The entire church is structured around these books. And the consequences of that are huge. The entire structure of the church is based on a lie. It's based on a forgery. It's based on somebody saying, I'm going to set out how I think it should be structured, and I'm going to do that by pretending to be the Apostle Paul
when you're reading your Bible, you have the New Testament structured in a way that makes you think that it's all contemporaneous. Instead of seeing that the pastoral epistles are written maybe a century after the Pauline writings, when you read it side by side, you imagine that these church positions of authority existed throughout the very beginning of Christianity. That is just not the case. When Paul is writing his genuine seven letters, the church is structured in a completely different way than described in the pastoral epistles. A much more established Christianity has a much more structured authority system, gets laid on top of the earlier texts. These are the texts that give authority to bishops, set up church leadership, figure out who's excluded from church leadership. They've become the blueprint for the way that the church operates. If it's just written by someone pretending to be Paul, it just creates a huge problem.
The role of women can't be understated. It kind of permeates everything. In the genuine letters of Paul, we have a more simple or archaic version of the church, because the Christian church was just starting out. And you had people meeting in houses. Paul talks about households, and the churches were households. People were meeting together. Different people would bring teachings, including women. And you had women church leaders, women apostles. But by the time you get to the pastoral epistles, you're talking about a much more organized actual church setting where you have elders and deacons, bishops, women completely being stripped any leadership roles at all, to the point where they're not even allowed to speak. One good reason why scholars think that these are forgeries, it's clearly written in an era that Paul wasn't familiar with. A lot of developments happened in theology and in structure that wouldn't have been present during Paul's lifetime.
There are certain qualities that are integral to Paul's thought are upended in different ways in the pastoral epistles.
Christians that want to talk about justification rarely go to the pastoral epistles because they just don't stress justification by faith as the means of salvation. But in the pastoral epistles, less emphasis is placed on that doctrine, and it's more focused on practical matters of church organization and conduct. The undisputed letters contain Christological passages affirming the divinity and pre-existence of Christ, like in Philippians. However, the pastoral epistles have a more muted Christology, and there's fewer explicit references to Christ's divine nature and cosmic significance. And the eschatologies, Paul's teaching about the end times, and we've talked on this show a lot about this. In the undisputed letters, he emphasizes the imminent return of Christ and the resurrection of the dead, 1 Thessalonians and 1 Corinthians. In contrast, the pastoral epistles, they don't talk about that. It's much more of a focus on practical instructions for the church out into the future. Paul seems to be concerned with the imminent return of Christ. Don't get married. Don't give your children in marriage because Christ is going to be returning any day now. But now we're talking about a different age of the church where the expectation of Christ's imminent return doesn't seem to be here.
That's one of the biggest clues. The earliest followers of Jesus thought that he was going to return very soon. You even have that idea expressed up until the middle period of New Testament texts. I would put Luke, 2 Thessalonians, Revelation in this era of texts where they're trying to maneuver through what they feel like is a delay that's happening and make sense of it, but still hold on to that hope that Christ is returning at some point soon. And then by the time you get to the Gospel of John, it's a completely different perspective. The pastorals are even further because it seems like at this point, the church is hunkered down, in it for the long haul, has roots, has created structures of authority and hierarchy. This doesn't sound like a radical apocalyptic community anymore. This sounds much more like just an established religion. Paul's great despair in Philippians and Romans is that maybe he's not going to see Jesus' return, but he's still holding out hope, even if it doesn't happen in his lifetime. He still knows that it'll be soon. Paul really thinks that we're living in the end times. That's so central to his thought.
Right.
And so for him to have this radical change doesn't fit with what was so central to his theology before.
And even in the book of Acts, Ben, which describes Paul's journeys, Acts was written after the life of Paul. But the pastoral epistles show even a more developed Christianity than we even see in the book of Acts.
Acts shows the development from the real letters of Paul. Paul is speaking to disorganized communities. Part of the problem in Corinth is that they've been given spirit, and so there are no leaders. So it's just chaos or different leaders competing for who has control. But it's clearly not that they have this established hierarchy, bishops, elders. This is just a totally foreign concept to the community Paul is talking to in Corinth. This is something that clearly is happening later on in the second century. This is one of the two biggest clues that this book is not written by Paul. Because Paul and the earliest apocalyptic material that we find in the Synoptics, whole theology is based on this idea that we are living in the end time. It's this revolutionary community that's ready for the end to come at any moment. Institutionalization can only happen after they've resigned to not having Christ come soon.
Another important point to talk about, Ben, is the manuscript evidence. The earliest manuscripts we have that include the pastoral epistles, they have the pastoral epistles, but they don't attribute them to Paul, which I think is really interesting. Because it seems like another author came along, wrote these books, and then down the line, they became attributed to Paul, even though they weren't actually originally penned by Paul. One way to look at this is, and I've talked in this language a lot, someone pretended to be Paul in order to gain authority and move the church in the direction they want. Well, that might not have been the case. It might have been just some church leader wrote these letters. They were popular, and so somebody else, a scribe or other church leader, came along and attributed those to Paul. Codex Sinaiticus in the 4th century, one of the oldest complete manuscripts of the New Testament, does not include Paul's name on the titles. That omission raises questions about the traditional attribution of authorship. Also, Papyrus 46 in the 2nd century, one of the earliest and most significant manuscripts of Paul's letters, and it has portions of several Pauline epistles, including the pastoral epistles. Again, it leaves out Paul's name in the titles of the pastorals. So these letters may have been in circulation and then later became attributed to Paul.
We're sort of dancing around it, but in some ways these letters seem like they were written to counteract Paul.
Right.
The Pauline tradition doesn't end when Paul dies. There continues to be works of literature created embellishing Paul's missionary journeys, and it was a popular type of literature. Dennis MacDonald has theorized that the Acts of Paul and Thecla, second century literary work about Paul, interrupts a woman's wedding. She starts following him around on missionary journeys, almost martyred, performing miracles and whatnot. It was extremely popular. There are parts of the pastorals referencing the Acts of Paul and Thecla. So it's possible that these letters are anti-Paul, written to counteract the real Paul with a tradition in Paul's name. Gerd Thiessen, in his book, says that the most disturbing thing about the pastorals is when the author, he's most forceful when he's in disagreement with the genuine Paul. Your theory that these texts were floating around and eventually have Paul's name attached to it, that that happens with even the Gospels, a person to tie this tradition back to the early church.
I'd really want to get into more what you said about the pastoral epistles are actually opposed to the genuine Paul. We've done a two-part series on the role of women in the church, and we talked about the pastoral epistles. So you can go listen to that, but we're going to talk about that more here and on our next episode. Overriding all of this is the role of women. It's the biggest controversy involved with the pastoral epistles. And what would the church look like? Would there be women, elders, pastors, deacons, etc.? It's the pastoral epistles that explicitly lay out that no, there can't be. To be fair, there is verses elsewhere in Paul's work like in 1 Corinthians. But some scholars think that verse is an interpolation and added later, because elsewhere Paul talks about women actually teaching in the church by the pastoral epistles in the second century. What you have is women having to be completely submissive to men and learning from their husbands at home and being quiet. What is really baffling, it seems to talk about how women's salvation has to do with having children. This goes completely against the genuine Paul, because the genuine Paul, frankly, didn't want women to have children because he didn't even want them to get married.
The way that evangelicals read the Bible is you're reading Timothy next to Ephesians, next to 1 Corinthians, and so it's natural to read 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus perspective back into Ephesians and back into 1 Corinthians. So there's a lot of things that people say about the 1 Corinthians passage. Some people think it's a rhetorical device that Paul uses, where he's sort of in conversation with himself. He seems to negate himself right after he says he doesn't allow for women to teach. He's talking about women in roles of leadership in the Corinthian letters. Like John said, some people think it's an interpolation. It showed up at different places in manuscript. Some scholars have done a lot of work on trying to trace the textual variants. But if you're reading that with the assumption that Paul holds the view that the author of the pastorals holds, then you're just going to say, well, you're talking about an interpolation, but he sets the same stuff in the pastoral. Or Ephesians, wives, submit to your husbands. You're like, well, see, there goes sexist Paul again. Typical Paul. He hates women. Because you have the pastorals, you read that back into these other passages. I don't think Paul wrote Ephesians anyway. B, you read those other passages with the pastorals in mind. How much of a difference? This is the go-to passage for gender discrimination in the church. Has most fundamentally caused a power imbalance between men and women in the church. And like John said, the most baffling thing is the saved by childbirth. It seems to violate Paul's most central teaching about salvation, and also one of his teachings about marriage or having children, creating a family. It's incredibly damaging. I don't think it can be overstated. If you could imagine a world without the pastorals, how differently people would read these other passages and how differently people would think about Paul as a person.
Yeah, and on our next episode, I really want to dive in with a lot more depth into that exact question about Paul's conception of salvation and then what he says about women and childbearing, etc., because I think that deserves a closer look and a lot more exploration. But Ben, I think it might be a good idea to conclude it for now. Like I said, we'll pick it up next time. I'm still talking about the pastoral epistles and the role of women. But there's a really interesting Bible Says What today that I think will be fun to explore. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do it.
Bible Says What?
Today, we're going to take a look at a very interesting passage that Ben recently pointed out to me. I had probably read this a million times and it just passed right over it, never thought anything interesting about it. But we're talking about a passage from Galatians, Galatians chapter 3. I'll let Ben introduce it.
So I'm going to read Galatians 3:1. This is in the New Revised Standard Version, and it's the updated edition. You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? It was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly exhibited as crucified.
Galatians is not a book that Ben or I, or I don't know many at all, people that would question the genuineness of it. So Paul wrote this. And if you read Galatians, I think it's pretty clear to anybody that this is a genuine letter. Because so much of the letter, Paul is not happy, and it seems like people are challenging his authority. People are coming into the community and claiming, no, you need to be circumcised. You need to follow the old Jewish law if you're going to be a Christian. And remember, this is before the New Testament was written. So Christians are trying to figure out, what do we do? Like, how are we organized? What are we supposed to believe? You know, what's our creed, if you will? And Paul is vehemently against this idea of Judaizing Christianity, because he's going into the Roman world, the Greek and Roman world, where he realizes the challenges that would be faced by new Christian adults having to be circumcised and also adopt all the other Jewish practices and laws. I mean, Paul's trying to say, no, that's done with. You don't have to do that anymore. And he seems really frustrated by people trying to go back. And this is really what Galatians is about. Galatians is Paul trying to set the record straight. And it gets into the dispute that Paul claims that he has with Peter and the Jerusalem church. And he does a lot of defending himself. I didn't get my message from these people. I got it directly from Jesus. It's like, yes, I did go to Jerusalem, but it was only for this amount of time. And there's a lot of equivocating that Paul does in this letter. So I don't think anyone questions the genuineness of this. Well, there are some, but for the most part, this is why it's referred to as undisputed. But the interesting part about this passage is that Paul says, you guys know that this is true because you had a visual representation of the crucifixion presented to you. It almost sounds like he's saying, hey, you guys saw the crucifixion of Christ yourselves with your own eyes. He actually uses the term, with your own eyes. So what does that mean? And we're going to get into it. Every translation have a different answer for this question. And it made me theorize something that I looked up, and apparently other people have also theorized this, although it's certainly not the majority view, that maybe this is part of some sort of vision that the congregation in Galatia had, where they actually had some kind of vision of the crucified Christ, which is, if you read word for word what Paul is saying, it's one of the best explanations for what he's saying there. I think the most common interpretation of this is Paul is saying, well, in my preaching to you about Jesus, I represented Christ crucified, just in my preaching. But I don't think that's really what the words suggest. The words seem to suggest that they visually saw something. And I'm wondering, Ben, what your take is on this.
Yeah, so it's fascinating. I heard a Muslim debating Christians using this verse on TikTok, and they were trying to say that, oh, look, Paul is saying these early believers don't believe that Jesus was actually crucified. So Paul is trying to convince them that the crucifixion took place. I don't think that's what Paul's saying here. I think John is much closer to what's going on in this passage than that. What Paul is saying is you're not believing anymore, even though you saw Jesus crucified. Now, Paul didn't even see Jesus crucified, and Galatia is not in eyesight of Golgotha, where they could see the physical crucifixion happening. And then there seems to be just a huge variation in translation between the NRSV and looking at, you know, I did just doing research on the passage, everyone translates it a little bit different. It does seem like some people think that it goes along with some sort of just a very descriptive message that Paul is giving. But I would argue that Paul elsewhere talks about divination experiences that he has, that the Lord comes and speaks to him. And that's how he learns things. Like, that's how he learns about the Lord's table. I think that it's not inconceivable. And in the context in Galatians, too, he's talking about some sort of spiritual, powerful experiences. He says, did you receive the Spirit by doing works of the law or by believing what you heard? Are you so foolish, having started with the Spirit? Are you now ending with the flesh? Did you experience so much for nothing? If it really was for nothing, well then, does God supply you with the Spirit and work miracles among you by you doing the works of the law or by believing what you heard? So Paul, literally in this context, is talking about the Spirit moving, miracles, and also the language itself, the bewitched you and before your eyes, the evil eye. So the way that Paul is using figurative language and also the context, I don't think that your interpretation is out of left field at all. I think it actually makes a lot of sense of the data.
Yeah, like in 1 Corinthians, Paul goes on and on about the gifts of the Spirit. He makes a very big deal. This is central to the historical context around the genuine Paul. Gifts of the Spirit were real. These people were experiencing, according to him, we did an episode on this called Superpowers from Jesus. And we talk all about this, about how these people were experiencing what they claimed to be supernatural abilities and powers. Paul himself, his whole experience, his whole conversion was a supernatural vision that he had from Jesus. He claims elsewhere that he communes with Jesus and gets supernatural revelation directly from Jesus. What makes a lot of sense, there were those in the church that claimed to have visions of Jesus. Whether or not it was a mass vision where everyone experienced the same thing, that I don't know. My tendency is to say no, it was people claiming that they had these visions and it bolstered their faith. It was something that was an important part of, they would rely on that heavily for believing and trusting that these things were true. There were those that claimed they had these visions, and to them it bolstered their faith, and Paul knew that. And so Paul is using this as a way to back up what he's trying to say, to the point that he's trying to make. He's using that experience that people claim to have in the church. Did they actually have it? I don't know. I think it's the same thing now. But many churches right now in America will have congregational members that claim to have visions and supernatural encounters with Jesus. And I think it was the same thing, if not more so, in the first century that we're seeing here with Paul.
Paul having divination visions is much more akin to what he claimed than the description of Acts. This is the way the resurrection appearances work. People had dreams or visions. They saw Christ resurrected. They saw Christ crucified. And it led them to belief. There's a lot of different scholarship, like I said, on Galatians 1 to piece together like what exactly it means, whether it's talking about an actual image that was made. John and I spoke about this before. Was it some sort of a pictorial representation of the crucifixion? One of the commentaries that I read even said that in the ancient days, that would also be part of the strategy of speaking, would be to use visual representation, or if it was just Paul making reference to his own rhetorical skills and his ability to paint a picture with his rhetoric. It seems to be perfectly plausible that he's speaking to an actual divination experience, like John says.
Yeah, that's also interesting, though, that, I mean, we do have some ancient representation of the crucifixion. Obviously, it's the most common representation in Christian art all through Christian history. So it's not that far out of line to say, hey, someone might have literally painted a picture or there was some kind of a sculpture that was presented at one of the churches in Galatia. And that's what Paul's talking about. That's very possible. It seems like there's something going on here, though, that is not known explicitly from a modern reader's standpoint. He's talking to something that the churches in Galatia understood by reading that we don't understand now. I think the most obvious reading of it is it's some sort of a vision, some sort of a supernatural encounter that they had. Because like Ben said, he immediately goes into them receiving the Spirit. That is right in the context of this text here. But it's a little bit of a mystery, and it's certainly interesting. And I think it's something that's largely missed, if I'm right, and scholars have pointed this out as well. So I think I'm in good company. It really is fascinating because it gives you a little bit more of a window into the early church. And earlier in this episode, we're talking about the pastoral epistles. This is an earlier form of the church here, where they were really relying heavily on the gifts of the Spirit and not as much on church organization and hierarchy.
Yeah, that's the whole context that this is happening in. The other thing that perhaps he's making a reference to is he's in conflict with teachers, not James and Peter directly, although maybe James and Peter directly, but certainly with the Jerusalem church. And so maybe it is people that actually witnessed the crucifixion, but that seems unlikely because the ones he's writing to are not Paul's opponents. He's writing to the people that he's trying to keep from being swayed by his opponent. The language is really unclear. I think John is right. There's sort of a gap. I think it's another example, like we spoke about last time, of something that people read over really quickly and maybe don't give a second thought to. And then even when the Muslim person on TikTok brought it up, people were sort of dismissive of it. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. I don't know that I ever noticed this before. So it just further confirms, it sounds like John agrees, the experiences Paul is having are divination experiences, and these are charismatic communities that he's speaking to that are also having these similar experiences.
What I think is interesting is when we were talking about this, we were going back and forth, and we were looking at all the other translations, and it seems like each translation kind of came up with their own unique way of understanding it, which showed me that everyone was kind of confused by this. No one has a clear answer. Do you want to go through a little bit like what these translations said and how their perspective changes one from the next?
Yeah, we should do that. I mean, so there's a saying that translation is always interpretation. And I think that's true when it comes to this passage as well, because it was like every single translation that we looked at had some sort of a different take on it. All right, so the first one that I have is from Robert Price. And Robert Price is a mythicist that is extremely skeptical of even the genuine Pauline epistles. So he translates it as, "Senseless Galatians, who is it who has cast a spell on you? The crucifixion of Jesus Christ was plainly demonstrated from Scripture before your eyes."
I guess it would be important to read the literal Greek. We're not Greek scholars, and we'd really need to interview one. But in the fact that all these different Greek scholars have come to varying positions on this shows me that they don't have one clear solution to the issue.
So I won't torture you by trying to read Greek, but I do have Bible.com translation. So this is probably the most generic, hopefully wooden literal translation. "O unthinking Galatians, who charmed you? The truth to not yield to, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was written about beforehand, among you being crucified." So that's obviously, I mean, that's very different than the NRSV. The translators at NRSV know how this language is working a little bit better than a wooden translation. So the CEV, which I believe is the Contemporary English Version, says, "You stupid Galatians, I told you exactly how Jesus Christ was nailed to a cross. Has someone now put an evil spell on you? I want to know only one thing. How were you given God's Spirit? Was it by obeying the law of Moses or hearing about Christ and having faith in him?"
Yeah, that kind of glosses over it. It doesn't actually address the references to seeing with your own eyes are not present in that translation.
Yeah, there's such a wide range of what the translators are doing. This is the plain English version. "Listen, you mob in Galatia. I told you clearly why Jesus Christ died. It's like I painted a picture of him on a cross for you all to see. And now you're forgetting him. You are so silly, it's like somebody tricked you."
See, that's interesting, because the Greek translation, I don't think it could render it as if I painted a picture for you. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know Greek. I'm not, I'm being very open with my limitations here. Like we said, every single translation has a different take on what this could possibly mean.
Yeah, you can see clearly the interpretive lens that the translators are using. So if they think that it's some sort of a visionary experience, they're translating into some sort of a visionary experience. If they think it's something that Paul is demonstrating from Scripture, then that clearly comes through in the translation.
Right.
And if it's a metaphorical picture that Paul is painting through rhetoric, then they make that pretty...
When Paul talks about Scripture, the New Testament hadn't been written yet. Paul is literally writing the New Testament in Galatians. So he's talking about the Old Testament, and Jesus was not crucified in the Old Testament. So he's really talking about the fulfillment of prophecy when he talks about scripture. The majority of the translations talk about Christ's crucifixion was demonstrated before your own eyes. And I think any other translation is trying to get around that difficulty, because it is a difficulty. Well, they obviously didn't see the crucifixion live. So what is Paul talking about? There's no clear answer to that. It's difficult for a translator to, do we make our best inference here? What do we think he's probably saying? And that's what most of these are doing. And it's hard because there's no clear answer.
There's a huge difference between publicly portrayed as crucified or pictured as crucified or displayed publicly as crucified or known that was crucified. Yeah, I agree. It's a problematic, unclear text, and that's why you see so many different variations of the translation. And John's right, it could create theological problems depending on how you translate it.
Well, I don't know if we've beaten this one to death. Ben, me and you can go back and forth on this for hours. It's just kind of fascinating to give you a little insight into the first century Christian church in the days of Paul. We'd be very interested to hear what all of you think about this and what your take on it is. So don't hesitate to message us online or email us. That probably wraps it up for this episode. Ben, why don't you end with a quote?
Okay, we're going to end with a quote from Carl Sagan. We can judge our progress by the courage of our questions and the depth of our answers, our willingness to embrace what is true rather than what feels good. Good night, John.
Good night, Ben.
The Skeptic's Bible Project is a John and Ben production, with intro music by John Lobker. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/skepticsbibleproject and follow us on all social media platforms at Skeptics Project. Got questions or comments? Email us at skepticsbibleproject@gmail.com.